It was the closest finish in the history of the Indianapolis 500. It may well have been one of the greatest Indy 500s of all time. And that leaves us with one thing left to say. If you don't like that kind of racing, don't even watch. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
Hey everybody, Dre Harrison back at it once again with two more episodes of Motorsport 101 being recorded today. This is episode 657. Of course, as usual, joined by RJ O'Connell and Cameron Buckley. Always a pleasure to have them around. The timing on this was a motherfucker. Just as we put out the first of our two episodes last week, we got a bit of horrible breaking news to come out of the world of NASCAR, and well, probably one that transcends towards all of motorsports. And hell, it's quite wild when even the bottle of ranch dressing in chief, the President Trump, acknowledges what a horrible loss this was, and the one time I'll ever agree with him. We lost Kyle Busch out of seemingly nowhere. We'd heard rumblings of a sinus infection he'd been dealing with. We'd only found out about 12 hours earlier that he was going to miss the whole of the Charlotte race weekend due to illness. It was called a severe illness. And then later that night, we got the horrible news that he'd passed away. Just a complete and total shock to us all. I'll take a little step back here for a minute, and I'll let RJ and Cam lead the way because they're more, you know, the NASCAR people than I am. But just a startling, shocking loss out of nowhere, and one that's hit us all for six.
Yeah, and to clarify, like, we don't talk about NASCAR regularly on Motorsport 101, but that doesn't mean we don't sit around every once in a while, watch it together, talk about it together. And Kyle Busch is one of the greatest NASCAR drivers that's ever graced the circuit. That can be no question about it. He left us with 63 Cup Series victories, 234 across the big three national series. That's Cup. That's what we now call the O'Reilly Series. That's trucks. He got his 69th truck win days before Wednesday when he fell severely ill at a Chevrolet simulator near Charlotte. Seemingly out of, like, this is blindsiding, right?
Yeah, we found out in the days afterwards that it was pneumonia that had unfortunately evolved into sepsis, and sepsis is real bad. That's one where it can go south in hours, in the worst of circumstances. It's why whenever people get pneumonia, I've been there, you always check for sepsis, because it can come around rapidly, and if it does, you could be in real trouble. And yeah, that's unfortunately exactly what this was.
It hurts. And I know, paradoxically, like, Kyle Busch always loved being the villain of NASCAR. He understood that every NASCAR race needs a story. It needs its heroes and its anti-heroes. Kyle Busch played the latter role oh so well. Did he take it too far sometimes? I'd say so. But he was just so talented that he made everybody else around him, all of his peers, everybody that chased him every single weekend, every single day of every single weekend that they went out for a race, that much better, because they were that much more motivated to stop him from winning. I remember back in 2020 when the NASCAR Truck Series put a bounty on him to stop him specifically from winning all these truck races, because Kyle was one of those dudes who, even though his legacy in the Cup Series alone was just so great, he would always go down and run as many other races as he possibly could. And chances are he would go out and win those races, right? And he always gave us so many memorable quotes, so many great radio crash outs, which is kind of a strange thing to say that like we're looking back on this with fondness, because I think what sucks about this is like, obviously, he's left behind a wife, two children, a brother who, and Kurt, who, let's not forget, didn't get to write the final chapter of his own racing career. He's left behind a team that's been through all of this exactly 25 years ago. He's left behind a fan base that has become number and number to shocking circumstances like this. Like, a lot of people brought up the comparison to Dale Earnhardt because Earnhardt was Richard Childress's driver. Kyle Busch was Richard Childress's talismanic driver. I know these years have been tough for him, but when you look at him, the way he performed in the Truck Series, you think he still has something left to give the sport and he can't give it back. And to the fans, they've been through this. They've been through the loss of Greg Biffle and his family. Chances are, if you're older, they've been through the losses of Davey Allison and Alan Kulwicki, which feel so sudden because one day they're there and the next minute they're just fucking gone. And it really is a shame that Kyle's not going to be around anymore to just like talk about all these stories in his old age when he's retired and ready to step away from the sport and look after his son, Bretston, who, lovely gesture from RCR to pull the number 8 out of circulation and save it for when Bretston is ready to go racing a cup. I think that's a lovely touch. I'm still in shock, man.
I don't really know how to follow any of that up. I mean, just as mentioned, completely out of the blue. He's here 1 minute. He's claiming a checkered flag from that truck race 6 days before he's gone. Just one of the generation defining drivers, a mercurial talent in every sense of the word. Either someone you love to watch or someone you love to hate watch. And I know which camp I was always in, even as a little kid. But now I feel like the Joker having lost his Batman.
Right.
Racing doesn't have a punchline anymore. It's not fun. Yeah. I look at it and just larger than life figure and just unbelievably talented on track. I mean, you can go watch. There is hours and hours of Kyle Busch highlights going back to his initial days with Hendrick and Busch. And that man could wheel a car with the best of them.
He could step into a G3 car tomorrow, which he did at a Rolex 24. And he was not bad. He wanted to do the Indianapolis 500. That's along with Badly. Winning the Daytona 500 were the two big milestones in his career that unfortunately he never got to cross off in his life in racing.
Went to Carl Austin instead.
To the point where it was even drawn up and mocked up with an M&M's car. Pour out a bag of peanut M&M's or another type of M&M if you're not so inclined for Kyle. But just I don't know what to say. I don't know what I'll be able to say.
We're all just in shock right now. When you think about the other components too, his Truck Series team gave so many people their start, and that Truck Series team became part of what we now know as Spire Motorsports. And I thought it was only fitting that Daniel Suarez, a Spire Motorsports driver, one of the people that went to bat for Daniel Suarez early on in his career, got the win in the Coke 600. I thought that was very lovely. Some of the lovely gestures, even from the guys that have always been, Kyle Busch's main rivals. Guys like Dale Earnhardt Jr., just I don't know how he finds the words every single time so eloquently to put all of this into perspective. Like his initial statement when we lost Kyle, and then following up that with the piece that he narrated for Prime Sports before the Coke 600, just really beautiful. Brad Keselowski had some really lovely words today to say they were rivals. Carson Hocevar was one of those children that hated Kyle Busch growing up and was just devastated after this loss. I just don't know what to say, man.
I think we all are.
Yeah. Such a young family. So, I mean, I watched the start of the Koenig 600 and the tributes to him. I don't want to be, I said this on Blue Sky and on social media, and I'll say it again here. You do not have to be strong when you're having to deal with unbelievable tragedy. I think it's an overused term when we're dealing with grief, because we expect people to be strong and to persevere. You absolutely do not have to be. Let me make that abundantly clear. But I do not for the life of me know how Sam and Braxton got through that. That was gut-wrenching. I had to step away from my monitor for a minute, and I'm not even, like I said, I'm not the future NASCAR person, but I can only echo RJ's sentiments that he got it. He understood it. And that's something that I don't say about very many people in all of motorsport. They get it. Like a Pedro Acosta type, someone who truly understands that racing is about stories. It's about people. It's about how to engage with people. It's about how to tap into people, whether they love you or they hate you. Like, I'm a pro wrestling guy. I'm wearing a CM Punk t-shirt right now. He loved this pro wrestling. He was a 24/7 champion there as well. He got it. He truly understood what it was like to be a polarizing figure in a sport where, let's be frank, we have more in common now with pro wrestling than we ever have when it comes to sporting fandoms. Take it from me. And Bush was the antithesis of that. On top of being an incredible winner, an incredible racing driver, and someone who had softened in his more recent years, who had started a family, who became a mentor figure to so many people. My favorite driver, Bubba Wallace, was one of the first people to say, I wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't for Kyle, because he was given his first opportunity thanks to him. He was a transcendent figure beyond NASCAR, and I don't use that term very often, but it's eloquent, and it's the perfect one for him. It says a lot when Indianapolis Motor Speedway lights up its entire tower for you on the 18th lap of the race. And even Formula One TV did a very classy touch to acknowledge him on Friday, the day after he had passed. That goes to show you just how beyond NASCAR he was as a figure. It's a devastating blow for us all in motorsport, and it will be a little bit less fun without him on the grid. That's for darn sure.
We'll be telling his story for many, many years to come.
A tragedy
That's
is
what he deserves.
Absolutely. The sad part is he's not going to be around to help tell those stories.
The least we can do to him is tell them on his behalf.
Yeah.
And one of them involves the 110th Indy 500, which, let's get straight into, because it's a darn shame you didn't wrestle. There's a lot to get through here, but I will do my best to paint the picture for you. It was a 500 that had us on edge for more than the 230-mile-an-hour top speeds. There were two threats of rain over the course of the race that had us questioning whether we were even going to get a finish on Sunday, whether we were going to get a called early finish, whether we're going to get all 200 laps in. We didn't know. We had to kind of wing it in real time as we were watching. All of a sudden, half of our Discord chat were weathermen. It's one of them things. It's part of the fun. But let's get some of the highlights out of the way. Doubly unfortunate was on lap 18 as the crowd fell silent for what was a tribute to Kyle Busch on lap 18. Sadly, Ryan Hunter Ray spun out on that lap. He was the first major incident of the race. He spun. Unfortunately, it took Catherine Legg with him, and that ended any hope of her getting the full 1,100 miles of the Memorial Day double. For those who were playing along to our prediction game last podcast, the final count, 568.5 miles. By Price is Right rules, we all went over. God damn it. That's unfortunate. And doubly unfortunate because Alpha done a fantastic job. HND done a brilliant job getting Catherine up to speed. And that was just a real gut punch to have her race end so early. We had the five laps of caution. And immediately on the restart, Takuma Sato turns down and takes out Ed Carpenter. And Carpenter was livid.
And he's telling Sato he's going for first.
Let's just say they had the camera on Carpenter as the field was passing back through. Ed was out of his car. You didn't need to be an expert lip reader to tell what was being said. Fuck you, in loud terms, Takuma was driving past. Yeah, not fun. So that was another set of cautions. We got about another 60 laps of clean running after that, the usual 500 fuel-saving affair of swapping for the lead and what have you. Until lap 92. On lap 92, we have a caution partly for rain, because there's a bit of moisture at turn four, partly because Will Powell's car has a fluid leak of some kind, and Will has to kind of save it by spinning it on pit road, basically.
Well, it spun because gear 3 turned into gear 33 as his gearbox exploded.
Yeah, that was unfortunate.
Same time as well,
yeah.
Alexander Rossi's car has a fuel line failure, which then sprays fuel over everything hot and basically melted down the entire back half of his backup car. If you picked Valentino.
You picked Alexander Rossi.
If you picked Alexander Rossi for last out of the front row finishers, you'd be correct.
Yay! Not that I wish ill will to anybody that takes part in this race. That's
just a shit deal.
That's the second year in a row Alex Rossi's car has gone up in flames on pit road, which is just doubly unfortunate. The poor man had to be hoisted out of his car because, as we found out, he had a broken ankle after that crash in practice. And a bit of a nervy one seeing him get pulled out of there, but thankfully he was fine.
Melted the roll hoop.
Yeah, melted the chassis of the car. Like, they've written off two tubs at ECR.
That's expensive. And like, this was a horrible 500 for ECR across the board. And that was the diamond in the ring on that one. So as a result of that caution, we don't get going again straight away. It does start to sprinkle with rain after a few laps of running behind caution. So that brought out a red flag. A red flag that for moisture. And a side note, Fox did a very good job here of interviewing Emma Davies Dixon, as Scott, her husband, was leading as the rain came down. We were past 100 laps, which in IndyCar rules means we now can call a finish on the day if necessary. So we were thinking, well, how long is this rain going to last? And the hilarious moment where Emma's like, I could have swore I saw lightning over there.
Get you a partner who believes in you the way Emma Davies Dixon believes in Scott Dixon. My God, that is dedication.
I think there was a time where we would have said, God, Emma Davies Dixon is just being so annoying, so extra. Could she just go away? But like, no, we need to appreciate these moments.
Yeah.
Scott Dixon is out there on track, not just because he's a legend, but because there will never be another Emma Davies Dixon when it comes to supportive partners in motorsports who are not afraid to just say whatever when put in front of a microphone. You can't replicate that.
She had no shame saying, yeah, we think we've been screwed out of this race like 8 or 9 times by now. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, Emma. God bless her. Like, I've had a couple of DMs with her and a couple of comments on Instagram here, and that she's a lot like that, but she's a really, really nice person. I just wanted to clarify that. But it is very funny. It was extremely funny. We did eventually get going again after the rain shower cleared. It was only light drizzle. Thankfully, we didn't lose the track or anything like that. So we're going into lap 125 and coming up to the green, and oh, there goes Joseph Newgarden at turn four. Oh, shit.
His car too low, trying to get some clean air on his front wing out of four, clips the curb. You go that low, you hit the curb, you're going around. Goes around and is out of the race after a spectacular recovery drive. Pretty much exactly as the form book said out of practice and qualifying. Not amazing in clean air. That car was goofy in traffic. That thing was stupid good.
Man said he saw last year's comeback from the back row, and he said, yup, I'll do it again, because he got from 24th to 10th in 30 laps.
And how did that end? The exact same way that it ended. Okay, not the exact same way, but regardless,
it's just a messy driver error.
Violent one. That was a violent crash. Turns out he was put in a walking boot when he got to the banquet the day afterwards. So that was clearly a nastier spill than what the TV lets on, because it was rough.
Joseph did say it's more for things to cosmetically heal as opposed to internal injury in that leg, which is good to hear.
Good. Abundance of caution, which is always when that term is used, it's normally good news, thankfully. So luckily, Joseph, relatively okay. He got out, got in the ambulance under his own power. Turns out he was put in a walking boot, but thankfully nothing more serious than that. But eventually we got going again on lap 132. And this is where things get interesting. We have the nice number of laps to go. And
nice.
There's two camps of thinking. There's one camp who thinks there is a rain shower that's going to land roughly with about 20 to 25 laps to go. Those guys are going to try and do two stops to the end, thinking they may not need the second stop, and keep track position because the rain will intervene and cut the race early. The other camp of thinking is the people that came in during New Garden's caution, thinking we can get to the flag on one more stop with a little bit of save, and they're assuming that they're going to get all 200 laps in. In the leading track position group, we had Alex Pillow and David Malukas at the front of that train. In the alternate camp of thinking about the guys that were going to go for the one stopper and go for the fuel save, Felix Rosenquist and Pato O'Ward. At the time we're watching this, we don't know what's going to happen. We think there was a band of rain that was close by, within maybe 10 miles. So we thought, oh, if this rain lands any minute, it could just end the race right there and then, and we just don't know what's going to happen. So pretty much from 1:32 onwards, it's all out war. Like, the elbows come out early, and we are racing at full speed. Malukas and Pillow are trying to fuel swap off each other again to stretch it out.
Throwing haymakers.
Trying to stretch it out as long as they can. Connor Daly was up there on point. This is the best 500 car Daly's ever had. He led the lead.
Fucker four wide into turn one to take the lead one lap. I'm like watching through my eyes. There was a good 20 lap stretch of him, Malukas, Pillow, and one other car just.
McLaughlin was up there. Dixon fell back a little bit. Yeah, it was violence at that point. It was all out attack earlier. Traditionally, you don't normally see elbows out to the final 50. This came out early because we just didn't know how long this race was going to be. If you're the track position guys thinking we got to get two stops to go to the end because we can't fuel save that long for a one stopper, the death number was about 185. That was the point of no return, basically. And well, turns out the wind blew that second band of rain away from the track. It never landed, funnily enough. So the track position leaders got hosed. They had to abandon the plan and come in early to guarantee they could make the end, which meant the alternate runners are now in the driver's seat. It's now Pato O'Ward and Felix Rosenquist fronting that second group for the net lead of the race.
There's one other that snuck in here, running third, Marcus Armstrong, who was kind of hovering around that alternate strategy group, just like his teammates. And it was all going so well until all of a sudden, Kyle Collette crashes and probably throws away a big Rookie of the Year check in doing so.
He was running 10th at the time of he hit the wall. He was looking real good for a top 10 performance on debut. Probably would have guaranteed him Rookie of the Year. That honor ended up going to Mick Schumacher in the end. He's $50,000 richer as a result of that one. But it was such a shame for Collette, who had a fantastic race up to that point.
For about 192 laps, he acquitted himself quite well for his first Indy 500.
Lost it in the marbles at turn two, smacks into the outside wall hard, car catches fire, wins the shit out of Collette, but thankfully he was okay.
Smacks is an understatement. I won't thank Tony George for many things about IndyCar, but I will thank him for the safer barrier. You can see that wall shudder across the length of the corner.
Now, we didn't realize this until we checked the rule book after this happened. It's now an official rule in the IndyCar book. if there is a race that has between 10 and 5 laps remaining, IndyCar will now automatically throw the red flag to try and ensure a green lap, a green flag finish, essentially. So the red automatically comes out with 7 to go. Everybody's back in pit lane. We're getting ready. It's the usual procedure, 2 laps to warm up under formation, and then what we thought was going to be a 4-lap sprint to the finish. Until Mick Schumacher hits the outside wall, grazes it at turn 1 on that restart lap. Thankfully, car is fine. He's able to continue. But, of course, IndyCar throws the caution, abundance of caution, completely the right thing to do. Take no chances. You don't know what that car's going to do. You don't know how it's going to behave. So caution comes out with 4 laps to go. Also, a new part of that new rule, if there's less than 5 laps to go, IndyCar will not put out a red flag. So there is a chance the race can finish under caution still. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment, but we were working out in our head, well, what do we do now? Yeah. Turns out it was a 1-lap final shootout for the glory of the Indy 500, and you had 4 main contenders. Felix Rosenquist, who had gotten to the front as a result of the previous battle in Pato O'Ward, was right there. David Malukas was allowed to basically catch back up because of that previous red flag. He's now in the lead group, as is Marcus Armstrong, as mentioned earlier.
Marcus Armstrong, who grabbed the lead on that restart just before Schumacher scrapes the wall. And if they don't throw the green with a lap to go, we're still talking about a Meyer Shank Racing driver winning the Indianapolis 500, but it's not Felix Rosenquist.
Indeed. So with everything on the line, with 1 lap to go, David Malukas takes the whole shot on the final lap of the 500, leads through the first 3 corners. Unbelievably, Rosenquist and Armstrong are side by side for 2 straight miles as Rosenquist and Armstrong refuse to give it up. And Rosenquist is trying to hang around the outside while Armstrong is trying to keep it pinned on the inside. Armstrong finally gives it up at turn 4. Felix has got a monster run off the final corner. Malukas had a poor exit. It's a drag race to the line. And in the closest finish in Indy 500 history, Felix Rosenquist wins the biggest race of them all by just 23 thousandths of a second. Oh, and the photo finish, maybe 4 feet. It's that close.
And look at that. That's nothing. The finish for third?
16 thousandths between Scott McLaughlin, Pato O'Ward, and Marcus Armstrong. Third, fourth, and fifth between them. It was even closer between those 3 in the fight for third. But it's the all-time closest 500 finish. Felix takes the glory. The biggest payout in 500 history. $4.4 million. That's a lot of milk money. Rosenquist wins. David Malukas has the heartbreak of back-to-back second place finishes at the greatest race of them all, and Scott McLaughlin gets his best ever finish at the 500 in third. What an unbelievable race this was.
Okay, of all the Indianapolis 500s that you've watched, Dre, where does this rank?
I'm still not sure about whether I put this one above or below 2024, because 2024 was the other, in my opinion, otherworldly 500. Like, no disrespect to Cam, but Palou's win last year was a bit of a damp squib by comparison on 500 levels.
It's not because of Palou, it was just because of the way the race played out. Indeed. This one, I know that, you know, late red flags, 1-lap shootout finish. I know that feels very sports entertainment to a lot of people, but I think in the end, you cannot say that the right driver did not win this race.
That's the greatest final lap I've ever seen at a 500. That was unfathomable.
It's the craziest, but it's probably the greatest.
Like that. That is 2 miles of side-by-side driving between Rosenquist and Armstrong at 220 miles an hour. And neither man wanted to give that one up.
You know what's crazy? It was calculated from Rosenquist. He was trying to side draft off his teammate. His teammate was probably trying to side draft off of him to try and get the momentum on Malukas.
Felix had said after the race.
Kept switching lanes to try and give them both to draft to try and disrupt it. All three of them were being very strategic about it down the backstretch. Yeah.
Felix would later admit after the race that he had never tried an outside pass at the 500 before, and next thing you know, he's 2 miles side by side with Marcus. Armstrong admitted after the race himself that he ultimately gave it up at turn four because his attitude was better to have one of us go for the win than I keep it pinned and we risk us both crashing. He was a phenomenal teammate in that instance. That is a driver that's mature beyond his years and incredibly unselfish because he had a shot. He absolutely had a shot with a mile and a half to go. And he was like, go get him, Felix. And Felix got there. And yeah, for me, it's the greatest 500 of them I've ever watched. And I've gone through, I think, 10 or 11 of these now. And it was magic. The emotion, like, talking about Felix as a winner for a minute here, because it's only fair we talk about him first. This is a man who has had a very strange relationship with this race. I mean, RJ's talked about it before in the preview. This race saved his career 4 years ago in 2022 when he finished in fourth. He has the fifth fastest qualifying run in the history of this race, a 234 mile an hour run he has on here. Yeah. He very quietly has become an elite runner of this race without a lot of people really clocking, apart from Chris DeHardy, the swine. This is a race that has become a key chapter in the story of Felix Rosenquist, the driver for hire, as we nicknamed him on this podcast. This was his strongest car he's ever had. That car was a rocket ship at times over the course of this 2 week period.
We were left perplexed how he didn't get pole position the weekend before, because in the rounds of time trials leading up to that, his was the quickest car right up until it mattered most and he needed to go get pole position, just like it was last year when Rosenquist had the quickest car only to lose pole position to Robert Schwartzman.
Mm-hmm. This had been coming. This is like the Marcus Ericsson win from 2022, where a lot of people were like, oh, it's Marcus Ericsson. He was a bust in F1. This must be a fluke. And then you look at the timing sheets and you realize Ericsson was top 10 in every major session. He had a competitive car the whole way through. He just took advantage of the opportunity that was presented to him. And then he shut down Joseph Newgarden where it mattered most. No easy task, as we've seen in future years. It's the same principle here with Felix. He had been knocking on this door for some time. Hell, how's this for some extra emotion? He'd just become a dad only weeks prior. We gave Felix Rosenquist new dad champ. That was a fundamental mistake. That's one way of looking at it. And let's not forget, he was battling Pato O'Ward, the man who was the best man at his wedding. One of his best friends in the heat of battle for the win. It doesn't get much more emotional than that. My God. Yeah.
And dude, to touch on the point that you made earlier, to explain why I think this race saved his career 4 years ago, you have to go back to 2021. Felix Rosenquist left Chip Ganassi Racing to join Arrow McLaren. Rosenquist had won his first race with Ganassi, had been rookie of the year in 2019, gets the first win at Road America, and then abruptly, he leaves for McLaren. His seat is filled by Alex Palou. We all know how that goes. 2021 was just terrible for Felix Rosenquist. He was not getting up with the setups they were giving him because the team is still very much built around Pato O'Ward, and their driving styles are much different. They go into 2022, and by about the month of May, you're thinking, well, Rosenquist may not be long for his time in McLaren. He may not be long for his time in IndyCar entirely. There were talks that he was wanting to go back to Formula E, where he had been before coming over to IndyCar, among the many, many other places he had been before coming to IndyCar. Let's not forget, He was a bit of an overager in old Formula 3. It took him 4 years to win the European Series title, and, you know, that comes with the stigma. But once he graduated, he was willing to get into anything and go quick in it, right? And then he goes out and he darn nearly wins the Indy 500 in 2022 with a performance that, in my opinion, saved his career in IndyCar. I know it wasn't going to save his career in McLaren because they were determined to get Alex Palou in and try and move on from Felix Rosenqvist. And for a variety of reasons, they can't really do that. Not in the way that they had intended. Rosenqvist gets a new lease on life at Meyer Shank, joining them at a time where I think it's safe to say going out of 2023 and into 2024 that morale at Meyer Shank Racing was a lot lower than it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't yet have the, but they get the Ganassi Technical Alliance. Rosenqvist beds in with the team. He's become such a good leader of this team. And every time he goes out, we're thinking, right, when is he going to win another one of these? Because it had been nearly 6 years since his first IndyCar win. We're wondering, is he ever going to win another one of these?
You're going to win any of them. You might as well win the big one.
And how's this? Meyer Shank Racing still only has two IndyCar Series victories. They are 5 years apart at the same event. Helio Castroneves in the 2021 Indy 500 and Felix Rosenqvist this past weekend, also at the Indianapolis 500.
It's a remarkable story. And yeah, like Felix has now become like a top 10 driver in the series. Like he's been an excellent leader with Meyer Shank. He's fast as all hell over a single lap. He really should. He was unlucky not to win a Long Beach earlier this season. Just a month and change ago, really. The pit crew, I didn't even really want to say let him down. It was just a monster stop from the 10 crew that put him out in second. That was a Long Beach race. He was dominated. That was a Long Beach race that Alex Palou didn't have an answer for him until that final stint. Felix can do this now. He's good enough where he can give anyone in the series a fight. And that was a monster fight. And that was one that he came out on top when it mattered most. And it was a monster win. And you know what? It was a universally beloved win as well. Yeah. I have never heard a single man say a bad word about Felix Rosenqvist in IndyCar as a person. Everybody loves him.
All the stuff we have said about the paint scheme on the car and the SiriusXM channel that is promoting, you will not hear a bad word said about Felix Rosenqvist, his missus, his new daughter who got a BorgWarner wreath of her own, which was beautiful. Absolutely adorable. Like, that was so cool to see. I'm happy for so many people at that team because this is the apex to what they've been building back to get to this point.
Absolutely. It says a lot that, like I said, not a single person has ever had a bad word to say about him. Everybody in IndyCar likes Felix Rosenqvist.
Yeah.
One of the first people to congratulate him was Scott Dixon, his old teammate from when he was at CGR. One of the first dudes out of the car. There's actually a really touching story of David Malukas at the banquet the following day. Yeah. When he first arrived at IndyCar as a rookie, he was in the back of the room at the first driver's meeting, was nervous, didn't know who to talk to. The first person who went out of his way to talk to him was Felix Rosenqvist. And David said, "There will not be a more deserving winner of this race than you."
Yeah, I know for David, that had to be just...
Oh.
What a young man that guy is, because we all saw it after the race. Like, that is one of the most torn up that I have ever seen anybody. And I get it because he talked about it. He's finished back-to-back runner-up in this race, back-to-back years. But last year it was because, like, cars in front of him got penalized. This year, Malukas had it. It was right within his grasp. And if not for Rosenqvist, not only running side by side, side drafting Arthur Armstrong, trying to pass him around the outside, but the move he pulls coming out of four to just snatch the car over to the right without disrupting the momentum and get the toe that would give him the pass to win the race at the line. That's just some incredible driving. Malukas was devastated. He was weeping in his post-race comments to Fox Sports and to IndyCar Radio thereafter. And I don't blame him, because this had been all that he'd been working for to get to this point.
Tell you what, like, he did everything right. If you wanted proof at Penske of why you hired this guy, that was 500 miles of proof, because he was fantastic, really, just all month. Even when Joseph and McLaughlin had made their way up the field, Lucas was still able to hold them back. And we know how strong both of them are at this race. He was really the only person who could go and fight with Pillow and continuously be able to go and try and hold him off. And those two went at it for odd, like 70 laps.
Quite possibly the best performer of the last fortnight across the board. And I know he's got a little bit of an advantage because he's in a Penske that have been proven to have been, you know.
A lot of people were happy to see Penske take an L, but man, even a lot of those people were just like, man, I feel for David.
Penske were anything but invulnerable this weekend. There was really, I would say, four teams that brought really great equipment to this race.
Yeah. For me, I mean, it was a gut wrencher watching David basically weep on the sidelines. The first person to comfort him was Marco Andretti, one of the very, very, very few people on this earth who knows exactly what it feels like to be David Malukas in that situation. And if anything, it's arguably even worse for Marco, because he had to bear the burden of the family curse for the better part of two decades off the back of his first 500 himself. If there's one person who knows exactly how that feels, it's Marco. And I'll say this much, he handled that defeat with a maturity and wisdom, way beyond his years. Yeah. That is a young man who, at his core, has got a heart of gold. And I'm really glad. Obviously, I'm devastated for him that he lost, because someone has to lose, especially when it's that close a finish. He lost the 500 by 4 feet. And the grace and the goodwill he handled that with, because I'll be frank, there's some people in that field who haven't handled defeat with as good a grace as David Malukas has. He's made a fan out of me, because that was incredibly mature, and I didn't know he had that in him. But what an incredible performance by that young man. That is exactly why Roger Penske took a punt on him a year and a half ago. It was for this race, and he proved everybody right about why he should have been put in that position in the first place.
It's not just that. Like, looking long term, like, I know Alex Palou is the overwhelming championship favorite and will be until proven otherwise. Malukas is now second in points. And even defeat, he showed why, look, if you weren't convinced even after this that Malukas is ready for prime time, I don't think anything will, short of winning a race or, God forbid, winning a championship. But I know that he's been ready for prime time for some time, and I know the first win is coming, and there will be many more to come. And a defeat like this is only going to make it that much sweeter when he inevitably wins the Indianapolis 500. Good health and opportunity willing. I will also say, and I'm throwing a bone to a lot of people, because Zach Brown is a very colorful figure. Isn't it funny how this 1-2 is a...
I know Zach Brown's sick.
That is the guys that have been jerked around by McLaren 1-2 finish.
Felix was let go by Zach Brown, and David Malukas let David Malukas walk because of the broken wrist injury he had last year. Malukas never got a shot 2 years ago. He never got a shot at this race in Orange, and they just finished first and second.
In direct combat with Pato, who, I have to say, shout out to Pato O'Ward. He made something from nothing, because McLaren were not good at really any stage this year. But
he's an alchemist at this race. He really is.
Well, he was on the alternate strategy on the one stoppers. got saved pretty hard at the end because he was two laps short relative to Rosenqvist. And he made it work. Got fourth in the end.
The only reason he wasn't really in there was because he had literally nowhere to go on the final half of that lap. Go where he was,
we had no fuel to burn either. He couldn't turn his engine up. He was still under the gun for fuel, even with the red flag and the yellow running.
By comparison, Felix had two laps more fuel than he did, than Pato did in his car, and that's ultimately was the big difference maker. In fact, as Ed points out in our chat, Zach Brown was so confident McLaren were going to win this, he flew Lando Norris down out of Canada. And by the way, Lando ended up rolling up early. We'll talk about that a little bit more in our Canadian Grand Prix episode next time of Asking. But Zach Brown made Lando fly down because he was that confident they were going to win this race. Whoops.
I don't know what cars he was watching all month, but great job by Pato. Yeah. And also, Scott McLaughlin did nothing, finished third.
You know what? He'll take that after how last year went. Look, he's always had quick cars at the Indianapolis 500. He's just never been fortunate enough to close the deal. Happened last year.
I'll just say, great, like my favorite line off the back of this race came out of Scott McLaughlin in the post race where he said, "It's like Christmas, but not everybody gets a present race in the 500. Yeah. Which I think is the realest shit he's probably ever said since joining the series. One more note on Pato O'Ward, by the way. That was his 8th 500 attempt. He was bumped the first time of asking. 6 out of the 7 times since he's finished in the top 6. He's outrageous at this race. Yeah. Like, so good.
Yeah, like that's it's a more impressive streak to me than the other streak which continued, which is, of course, Santino Ferrucci's top 10 streak, which is now going on for its 8th consecutive year. How does he keep doing it?
Santino was solid all month. He never looked like he was going to win, but he always looked like he was going to get a decent day out of it.
Yeah. Yep. He's done that quite a few times now where the car is a good car. It's good enough where it can contend, but maybe not that final extra half mile an hour where he can really think about winning it when it matters most. But look, say what you will about Santino. The man knows how to wheel it at Indianapolis. You don't fluke 8 top 10s in a row. Like, that's really impressive stuff. No matter, like, that's a guaranteed contender every year. You can't complain about that if you're AJ Foyt.
And was that Kyle Collette crash away from probably a double top 10 for AJ Foyt? Again, not race contending, but certainly solid if this is what they can produce every year. That's a good haul of points to get them up the order in the winner's circle.
What a great one for Marcus Armstrong, too. Top 5 finish out of it all. Could have won if the chips fell a different way.
Acura is already getting return on that investment.
Yeah.
I think you mean the return on that divestiture, or an argument.
I have to try and go to Petit and see the ARXs one last time.
Rinus VK, I told you fast Rinus VK at the 500 was going to be back on the menu.
P6, his best ever finish in this race. Well, that is an incredible result for Rinus and Junko Solinger Racing. Awesome. Awesome stuff. And that final restart, the penultimate one with 5 to go, that was incredible. Like, that man is fearless. And he must really hate Alex Palou.
Yeah, that's racing.
It's one of them deals. I'm going to do what we don't normally do on this pod. I'm going to run you down the floor as well and tell you there's a couple of little extra stories in the way to get through as well. Alex Palou was 7th in the end, and there's been some controversy since the end of this race because he's been docked 5 points and his team at Chip Ganassi Racing has been fined $10,000 for his car falling out of compliance. It was due to a part of his front wing having collapsed. And therefore the car fell out of compliance as a result of that in the back half of the race. It was deemed that CGR had not deliberately modified said part, and that's why the punishment was only a 5-point deduction and a 10 grand fine, where it could have easily been a disqualification. A lot of people drew an immediate comparison to Callum Ilott's disqualification for Prema last year. There is a couple of key differences here that are worth explaining because a lot of people got very cynical about this when it was announced, understandably, because first thing you've got to consider.
Clearly, a Roger Penske-owned series is going to trigger a pro-Ganassi conspiracy.
Right. Now,
exactly. It's the cartel working together, like the big sits in the Premier League working together as a cartel to keep Tottenham up.
Yeah. So to explain, my Marshall Pruitt did a very good job of this, explaining this in his racer.com mailbag article today. And I'll read this out verbatim. Prima was hit for an incorrectly installed front wing end plate that was clocked on the wing at an angle that did not comply with the minimum slash maximum height rule for end plates. The penalty was extremely harsh and was levied out of an alleged belief that the illegal installation was intentional, done with a disregard for compliance. Palou's front wing was tilting due to a bolt loosening. Looking at it from the front, the right side was high and the left side was low. There's a belief by IndyCar Officiating Incorporated, this is the new independent panel that evaluates this, by the way, it's a different set of referees than we had last year, that is important to distinguish, that it was an assembly error by whoever bolted the wing to the nose, or a thread locking solution like Loctite was not applied, which allowed the bolt to back out to the point where Palou's front wing assembly could be seen slightly leaning to one side in the second half of the race. So in other words, IndyCar compliant, the front wing started to fail, and basically IndyCar's officiating acknowledged that essentially this was done with no intent to cheat. It was a manufacturer's error, an assembly line fault, and hence only a minor penalty, not a full-blown disqualification that Ilott had last year.
Yeah, and I know there have been other disqualifications brought on in other series by Honest Car parts failures, like, let's say, skid block violation caused by broken suspension is the one that sticks out of my mind from a recent Rolex 24. Yeah,
Hinchcliffe's dome skid in that legendary Texas race. Back in 2016, right. you finished second, lost to Graham Rahal, then we found that afterwards. Here's a 25-point deduction for your dome skid being too worn out. That's a bunch, IndyCar.
Things like that ultimately stem from, like, running the car too low and gambling in that regard. This was a case where Palou probably got lucky.
Uh-huh.
Because if there was more green flag running, he might have had a front wing that looked like that Toronto race a few years back, and probably clubs that wall pretty hard at 225. That's racing. Happy knows how to putt at this track.
Yeah,
he was fast as fuck. Even with the front wing failing, he still only had like the second best car.
Yeah,
I'm cool with that. Palou's just a monster. What more can we say at this point?
He about was doing Palou? Some prime that damn Spaniard bullshit in the first half of that race. Pretty much any time someone went to go try and pass him for real, as opposed to fuel saving, that move around the outside of Daly and McLaughlin like had me again shattering my teeth, looking through my hands, like everything was about to end.
He's going to get another one of these. And to the point about, like, look, before we get our emails saying, oh, you're just a pro outs below podcast, of course, you're going to come to stop for him. All I just want out of this is that it's consistent and the explanations make sense along with the penalties levied, no matter how small or how large. Right. That's all we can ask for.
For me, personally, I've got no problem with how they officiated that. I was like, okay, that makes sense. You basically said, hey, this was an assembly issue. This you clearly have. Look, well, I said this in Formula One in regards to Austin in 2022 when Charles Leclerc and Lewis Hamilton was disqualified and what became skid block gate. I said it then, and I'll say it now. When it comes to motorsport scrutineering, you have to apply a sense of good faith that you assume the team in question has not cheated unless proven otherwise. Because if you take a bad faith mentality to scrutineering, really you should have to check every car for the entire rulebook because the presumption is that the team has cheated and it's up to you to disprove that. If we did that, we'd still be checking Felix's car now to see if it was actually within compliance or not, because IndyCar's tech book is about 70 pages deep.
Yeah, and I'd also like to add to the point about Callum Island before we move down the results sheet. Did anything else happen that weekend that might make the officiating crew a bit more vigilant during last year's Indy 500 to see if those were in compliance or not?
I can't imagine that the two smoothed out Penske attenuators or two engine covers from the two Andretti cars may have made the scrutineers a bit more, shall we say, cynical about the situation, given there was a high profile case in qualifying week that brought the entire sport into disrepute.
And they got their pants pulled down during that initial incident. Oopsie whoopsie. Going to round out the rest of the top 10, Romain Grosjean and Dale Coyne Racing, and I'll give credit to Towns Bell for thinking of this, because we don't often give that credit because he has grown into the Paul Tracy role in his time commentating for NBC and Fox. But he planted the idea that Dale Coyne Racing should change the number 18 on Grosjean's car to one that looks like Joe Gibbs's number 18. And if you don't know, that's the number 18 that Kyle Busch drove with for 15 years of his Cup Series career, which was a classy touch. And
gosh darn it,
a ninth place finish after the 500s that Coyne has been having lately.
Oh my God.
And the worst thing is, it could have been so much better because Dennis Hauger was with Rosenqvist on strategy and sped in the pits and threw it all away. He was running a net third.
Yeah.
He was running a net third with fuel to burn versus Pato. He would have been in the fight for the win.
Yeah.
And did the Dixon.
Could you imagine the headlines back home if Dennis Hauger's in play on his first attempt?
Wow.
Oh my God.
He did a
Dixon and sped in the pits. I mean,
the other thing is Mick Schumacher, we mentioned it. He won Rookie of the Year. Everybody said this is just a popularity contest. We know it is sometimes, but Nicole from the Orange Flag podcast made this point. Colette crashed. Hauger blew the race by speeding in the pit lane. Schumacher, apart from skidding the wall with four laps to go, drove a much cleaner race than the other three. Jacob Abel sadly was never a competitive factor.
Here's what I'll say. Nicole's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. But I also believe that more than one thing can be true at once, and there was no way that media pen was voting against the Schumacher. I saw the amount of headlines he was bringing in.
I don't know, man. If Colette brings that car home to a top 10 finish after the weekend he has, he brought the car in the fast 12. I mean, Schwartzman, all he had to do was win pole, and he could just disappear from the race last year, which is
that was the story
of the year. Yeah, exactly.
That was the story of that entire 500, besides Pelot winning, was Schwartzman's shock pole and the first Ricky pole sitter in, God, nearly 40 years.
Yeah.
So, it was.
It became the story of Prema's time in IndyCar, given they are still in flux, let's say.
Purgatory. I'll echo the sentiments of RJ. A very classy, a great idea from Townsend, because Kiffin Simpson did it too for his number 8 car as well, where he had a Kyle Busch style number 8 on his car, and that was done overnight via the help of Fox. So well done them, well done Townsend. And I know a lot of people has given him a hard time. Tremendous final call from Will Buxton. That was superb.
Watch the compilation of all the calls of that finish, because there's so many great ones. There's the Fox Sports English call led by Buxton. There's the IndyCar radio call, which is always high energy because you're calling it without the aid of pictures. There's the Fox Deportes call, and there's the fireplay call to the Swedish audience.
Oh, that was awesome.
I don't know what they're saying at that time, but they are so pumped.
Let's just say Felix Rosenqvist wins the Indy 500, transcends language, is what I will say on that one. A couple other notes as we go down the field. Takuma Sato in 10th, if that was his last one,
got it.
It's been a pleasure, Takuma, because my God, another incredible performance.
Only RLL car worth a damn here, and Ed Carpenter might not agree, but I remember watching, there was one point late in this race, Santino is following drafting off of another car, and Takuma goes flying by all three of them and is left speechless. Takuma Sato is still that guy.
Takuma Sato is 50 in January, and he's just finished top 10 at this race as a 49-year-old. My God.
In terrible equipment.
In not the best car by a mile. He's done it in an RNL. What a monster Takuma Sato is.
Like, and we've said it, like, if this is his last one, when it's pressure, but we've been probably saying this for about 10 years.
And he's still
having fun. He's just a crazy Japanese executive having fun.
Absolutely, absolutely madman. Great performance from Nolan Siegel, P11. Man, did he need that with Leonardo Fornaroli at the track watching on just in case in P11. Connor Daly, very unlucky to end up P12. He had a fantastic car this whole fortnight. He had top four pace easily, Connor Daly. That was the best episode of Should I Open It or Should I Keep It Sealed you will ever see in your life.
It ends the same way, dog. It's just like, I felt bad because, like, I know Connor Daly is going to run at the front. Every time he gets the lead, the crowd is going to go nuts, like Stone Cold Steve Austin and the glass shattering.
Oh, yeah.
And then I just wonder, how is he inevitably going to shuffle back down the order to a finish that his efforts don't deserve? And this time he just got caught out on strategy.
Yeah, it was on the wrong strategy. It happens. Marcus Ericsson, 13th. Kiffin Simpson, 14th. Scott Dixon led 32 laps on the day before that first rain shower. I think Emma may have jinxed him there. Just didn't have the pace in the back half of the race. Dropped to 15th in the end.
Very poor restart off of that initial rain shower where he started off leading. Below gets him into one, and then he lost like seven spots and just never was able to gather them back up. For the first 90 laps of this race, it looked like a classic Ganassi v. Penske slugfest, and then the rain broke it all up.
Yep. A rough couple of weeks for Carl Kirkwood ends in a P16 finish, and
never at the races. Andretti.
It's cost him a boatload of points to Alex Palou. He's now 49 points behind Alex in the championship race off the back of the league. You got to remember, Alex Palou got 12 bonus points for qualifying on pole position because of the fast 12 rules we have specifically for this race. So in the end, Palou, even with the deduction, left with 31 points. If nothing else, it was a good points day for number 10. Christian Lundgaard, free that brother, goddammit, in P17, ahead of Mick Schumacher, rookie of the year, as mentioned. He gets an extra $50,000 as a result of that award. Dennis Hauger, again, mentioned him. He was so close to a potential top three, maybe even more in 19th. Graham Rahal in 20th. Louis Foster in the rare club of guys who finished where they started in 21st, ahead of Jack Harvey. Stingray Robb in 23rd place ahead of Jacob Abel. Helio Castroneves' car had a mechanical failure before that final restart.
That's why he was out there for the victory celebration.
Yes, I was curious about that too. His car died after the red flag. They couldn't get it going again.
Keep in mind, he does have number 5 as a car owner. He co-owns the number 60 car.
Does that count?
Not really, no. But it is cool. It is cool.
Hey, as good news at the Concourse Club Miami. You don't have to repaint that Elio mural.
No, it's still good. It's still good. Kyle Collette, deeply unfortunate. As mentioned, had a top 10 car pretty much all fortnight in 26. Christian Rasmussen, just not at the races. All fortnight, and then a mechanical in the actual race itself.
Actually, through the race, consistent fueling problems. They had fueling problems every pit stop. They got worse. They never got better and eventually had to retire the car.
That's not very exciting, is it?
No.
Little cherry on top of the shit Sunday for ECR, really.
ECRs whose cars were 27th, 30th, and 31st in a field of 33. Rough, to say the least. Joseph Newgarden, as mentioned, for his crash on lap 124, was 28th. Will Power, who had a gearbox explode, and then that was the end of his race on lap 91. Alex Rossi in 30th. Ed Carpenter, 31st. Hunter Ray in 32nd. And Catherine Legg, sadly, bottom of the board in that one. In case you're curious about the IndyCar standings after all the shaking out of that, remember, it's 50 for a race win, of course, then 40, 35, 32, minus 2 down to 10th, and then minus 1 down to 5 points for the bare minimum. Also worth mentioning, the lap bonus is doubled at the 500, and it's also worth mentioning that you get between 1 and 12 points, depending on where you qualified. If you made the top 12, you would get points according to your finishing position. Alex Palou now has a 37-point lead on David Malukas, who is now second on the board, ahead of Carl Kirkwood on 49 points back. Then Christian Lundgaard in fourth, who's 78 points back now, ahead of Pato O'Ward on 188 points. He's 85 points off Alex Palou's leading 273. IndyCar is back this weekend. Traditional Detroit follow-up round. IMSA's there as well. RJ O'Connell will be there. The HRC paint
scheme is back.
The HRC paint scheme is back. Yes! I'm so DMing Devin about this and asking, can we please push for a diecast for Cameron Buckley's sake?
Yeah.
I just got a diecast, which is overlooking my room now.
Well, it's a good one.
It is a good one.
Gentlemen, your final thoughts on the final before we get out of here.
That was so cool. We're obviously downbeat going into this race for reasons that had nothing to do with, you know, the on-track stuff. Okay, not entirely due to the on-track stuff. It's a lot of off-track optics. I know we weren't feeling like super pumped about it going in, but man, we are super pumped going out. And look, we'll probably be reminded of like all the stuff that IndyCar is still deficient at. That's fine. Like, that was so much fun. Can we have more like this, please?
I just wish it was the Creed car and not the friggin' Morgan Wallen car.
It could have been the Eminem car that they just
right.
Dropped. Yes, yeah. Because Eminem is such an unproblematic figure.
Well, it's relative, isn't it?
There are the levels.
The difference is we like Eminem, so we turn a blind eye to a lot of his awful shit.
Did Sir Elton John give him the pass? No, not Pat Pass, the other one.
I love that chat Kira just put, Eminem just has mommy issues, he's not a racist. The bar.
There are levels to mommy issues, and Eminem has his own level.
Indeed. I will say, as much as it is frustrating that Morgan Wallen is going to be forever immortalized in the IMS Museum, for fuck's sake, that was one of the greatest Indy 500s of them all. I think the greatest final lap that race has ever had. That was the first 10 out of 10 I have given in the DRR review, ironically, since the 2024 Indy 500 2 years ago. Funny how that turns out in the end. Those are the two best 500s I've ever seen. That was an incredibly fun race. You never knew what was going to happen right until the last 70 laps are some of the most intense racing you will ever see, ever. It was an unbelievably special race, a special final lap, and a very, very likable and very cool winner in Felix Rosenquist, one of the real good guys in motorsport. And it's nice that for back-to-back years, the good guys won, quite frankly. It's good for them. I'll get out of here. Let's quickly do the social media stuff. If you've enjoyed the show and there's places you want to follow us, you can do that on our website, motorsport101.com. We're on Twitter, motorsport_101. We're on Instagram, motorsport101pod. We're on TikTok at m101_podcast. You can follow us personally. I'm on Blue Sky and Twitter, Dre Harrison, DreHarrison101. There, you can't miss me. My name's pretty easy to find. RJ O'Connell, C Buckley917 over there as well. YouTube.com for full episodes of the show for free is up there as well. YouTube.com/motorsport101. Facebook.com over there as well. And if you really, really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. You can back us at the $5 level to get all of our podcasts early, at least 12 hours before they actually go live to the public. You can upgrade to the $10 tier as well, and you can listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded on Riverside. Kira, Ed, Steve, Jace, Raptor, thank you all so much for watching along. Do stick around. We've got another Canadian Grand Prix episode to get through immediately after this one as well. But until next time, I've been Dre Harrison. They've been RJ O'Connell and Cameron Buckley. Thank you very much for watching and listening. And don't forget to keep it rowdy. Sayonara.
Later, y'all.
Never know when the last one's gonna be.